The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. I'm here with winery owner, winery winemaker. I don't think winery winemaker. That sounds horrible. This is a bad intro. We're going to continue with Sue Ann Staff here in Niagara. Sue, thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks for coming.
So I was wondering if you could first just tell people a little bit about the size of the property, and you know, you guys have been going on for, I think since 2009 is when you just devoted yourself to the Sue Ann Staff Estate Winery. But if you could tell us just a little bit about the property.
Right, sure. So the Staff family's been on the property here for over 200 years. We've been growing grapes for just over 100. So that makes me the seventh generation on the farm, the fifth generation to grow grapes and live in the big old white farmhouse here. So, right, so we're probably the oldest commercial vineyard in Canada. It was planted by my great-great-grandfather and great-great-great-uncle in 1899. It's a 3.3-acre block of Concords. That, some beautiful, beautiful fruit on it. But the family decided to go strictly into grapes in about the in the 50s, hard into it in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And so that really strong influence in grapes and wine was there throughout my entire life. So as a teenager, you know, it's all about grapes and wine. And I just decided when I was 16, I wanted to be a winemaker. And
was there a moment? Was there an aha moment for you when you realized, or was it just something because of your family that you know you were destined for it? I always like to ask that question. Was there that epiphany moment?
Right. I was about 15 or 16 years old working on a local neighbor's peach packing plant, and when you're working on a peach sorting line for hours and hours and hours, you come up with crazy things to talk about. And yeah, these older boys I was working with, they're like, well, why wouldn't you be a winemaker? I'm like, a winemaker? Oh, that sounds really cool. What's that? And yeah, it's perfect. It's a perfect combination of art and science together. I love both of them. And it got me thinking that, check, there's hardly any women winemakers at the time. And it would sound like the most fun job at the winery. So out it went.
And you were the first one to make wine. So was it before your family, they just would grow the grapes and sell it to other larger co-ops? So you were the first to in the family to actually make wine.
You got it. Yeah. There had been the aspirations to have a winery all along the way. But my grandfather was very adamant. We are growers. We are great growers. That's what we do. We do it well. They were very successful at it. Mm-hmm. So don't wade into that zone. So back when, for those who remember the days of Jordan Wines, there's a time when we actually considered buying it with a group of other growers, and that fell through. The whole industry kind of went into the dumps for a little bit too through the late 80s, early 90s, as we embarked into the Canada-US Free Trade Agreement. And there's not another family got hit harder with that than we did.
Really?
And we did pull out about 600 acres of grapes in one winter through a buyout program, just in a sense to eliminate the, not the inferior, I don't want to call it that, but the cheap, easy drinking jug wines that really had a place being made in California as opposed to Canada. And mm-hmm. So therefore they essentially eliminated us. So,
Actually, let's go back to one thing you said about the. We'll bounce around. All these questions. you said what you love about winemaking is it's the balance between art and science.
Right.
I was wondering for the listeners, because a lot of people listen. They're new into wine. Other people they're hardcore. It's sort of a weird balance. But if you could explain a little bit about what are the key parts to the art of this, mm-hmm. and a couple parts of what the science is to making wine.
Right. I'll start with the science of wine, because that's the. The technical part, the easy part, in a sense, that a wine, you can take anything down to numbers, quite frankly, can't you? Mm-hmm. So a wine comes down to what is the acidity, how fresh, how zippy, how acidic is it on the palate? How does that relate to the pH? They don't necessarily go hand in hand in wine, because there's so many other buffers there that would influence the pH. How sweet is it? You can take that down to grams per liter. How much even extract is in the wine? Take your wine and dry it right down to how much dry matter is left. We'll let you have an idea of how intense and complex the wine is. So we can make all those numbers perfect to make the perfect red wine or white wine. But then it lacks the artistry. And so in that part, we go to the wine. So what does it taste like?
Yeah.
And that, what emotion does it give you? What does it make you do? Do you just taste it and it just falls away and there's no love to it? There's no finish to it? Or does it make you think and ponder, like a really big kick-ass red wine that just, well, for me, that's what it is a big red wine that like changes and evolves in the glass.
Yeah.
And makes you ponder life. So
I love this quote from a Globe and Mail article. People who think it's cool to start wineries underestimate the work.
I said that.
Yes, you did. That's why I like that quote. I was wondering, just the typical day, and obviously it's not you don't have one set typical day because there's harvest, there's planting, there's, you know, then there's, you know, winter pruning and all that. But let's go first with what's the hardest time of the year for you?
The hardest time is also the most enjoyable time, and that's harvest. That's this time of year right now, mm-hmm. where we're into October. Harvest is happening October, November. They're long days. They're dirty. They're wet. They pull every single muscle in your body, and yet that's what you live for. Mm-hmm. So, and I think often people think the winemaking, I don't think people would understand what, when we go to the vineyard, we're not pulling full bottles of wine that's filtered and labeled off the vine. There's a lot to go into it. And 3/4 of the wine decision making happens when you're in harvest. Mm-hmm. And so if something's going to go astray in the fermentation, you better be on top of it during the fermentation, or else you'll spend the rest of the year trying to fix it. So you really, really need to be on top of it. So, and then of course is when you're releasing wines. And for me, that's all year long. So anytime there's a new wine that comes out, I'm pretty excited about that.
What are the hours like?
The hours are extraordinary.
Yeah.
And they're extraordinary because it's not only my job, it's also my hobby. And it needs to be my hobby because people that enjoy wine, it's their hobby. So it's taking up all those hours, your working hours and your hobby hours. And so if you don't love it, it gets really quite consuming and encompassing and can really be drained.
I asked Anne Sperling this, yes. winemaker at Southbrook and a whole bunch of places. When was the last time you went to the movies?
I don't even know. A long, long time. 3-4 years ago, maybe?
Yeah.
When was Avatar out?
Oh, my God.
I'm joking. But I'm not far from there. So.
Yeah. Winemakers, it's funny. It almost reminds me of people who have kids. Like my twin brother, before he had kids,
right?
He'd see every movie. Like we'd watch the Oscars together and he'd see every movie. Then he had kids and I'm like, hey, Josh, have you seen blah, blah, blah? He's like, I haven't seen a thing. I'm like, and that sort of reminded me of wine. Like when you become a winemaker, it's like, goodbye other things in my life, you know.
I had so many hobbies beforehand. It's crazy. And then, so it's a two-step loss in a sense. So I became a winemaker, lost a whole bunch of hobbies, and then I started a winery.
Yeah.
And now they're almost all gone. So
let's do one other quote and then I want to talk, I got 100 things. I want to talk about also all your wines and just why Riesling works here and why you love Riesling. But a winemaker is a glorified janitor. You're cleaning, cleaning, cleaning all the time. If you're not cleaning, then something is going to go astray. It's the most over-glamorized profession on the planet.
Yeah, I said
that quote too. Also from you about, I love that. A winemaker is a glorified janitor. I've not heard that one before.
Well, everything has to be clean. And if it's not clean, that means there's wild yeast and bacteria there. Mm-hmm. 90% of the time, that wild yeast and bacteria are not the good kind.
Yeah.
So there's some lovely ones out there that can actually enhance the wine, but there's those that most of them are not. And that's another one of those little creepy things that can creep into winemaking, that you've got to be on top of it through harvest. Mm-hmm. Or it's always being cold and dirty and wet. It's because you're cleaning all the time. So.
Yeah, yeah, I think the problem is when you see the commercials of, you know, wine country, and it's someone walking and it's idyllic and they're just walking through the vines, and one of their hands is feeling the summer wind.
That's 2% of it.
Yeah, exactly.
And as you walk through, and I love the ones that it's just you wandering amongst the barrels and like touching them and caressing them. Yeah. That doesn't happen. That does not happen.
And then there's you with the wine thief, and they're like, oh, let me see as the wine flows into the glass. And then you're doing the spin and the aromatics, and it looks fantastic.
It does. And I love when people come in to the winery here and it's like, oh, so what do you do all day? Like, yeah, I just lounge around. around and read some poetry and just, you know, and have all, we'll try the Riesling next. Yeah. So see how that's developing.
So, it's not how it happens at all.
When wine writers come to taste wine, that's pretty much the only time I crack open some of those older bottles of wine and see how they're developing. And or when, you know, mom comes over, hey, let's get through and taste this, or doing something we're proud of, but want to spend a bit more time doing tasting. I just don't give yourself the time. So
let's talk about your wines. And again, the Sue Ann's. I don't see, I come from radio, so I feel I have to reset, but this is a podcast. Someone's listening. They know I'm talking to Sue Ann Staff. We know we're at your winery.
Right.
Just if you were going to describe your lineup of wines, the rosés, the Rieslings, and such, just how would, I was just wondering if you could go over a couple of them for people.
Sure. So I basically have two series of wines. I have one series that are fully labeled under my name, Sue Ann Staff Estate Winery. Those are wines that would typically come from this property. So I've done everything, growing the grapes, made the wine, packaged it, selling it. The Fancy Farm Girl series is the other series. And that one is a bit more mainstream. If you're looking for my wine in the LCBO, that's the one you're much more likely to find. And those wines could come from this property and then some of the neighboring properties as well. Mm-hmm. But those are like, you know, 14, 15, 16, 95 each. And like just fun wines for cocktail parties. And
Tuesday. Gossiping.
Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. You got it. Exactly.
Yeah.
And the Sue Ann Staff series, those are, you know, the height of winemaking. And I really try to bring the family into those wines. So, and the property itself as well. So all the white wines are named after people in my family and all the red wines are named after things on the property.
Really?
Yes. I wanted to name everything with names of people, but then I realized we weren't prolific enough and not a variety of names as well. It was going to be a failing exercise. So
hold on. So they're named after the white wines for the Sue Ann Staff estate wines. Those ones are named after family members.
You got it. Perfect.
What happens if, have you ever had it where a family member's like, I'm really not liking my Riesling this year. I find it's just, it's a little too off dry for me. Do you ever have any family members going, Sue, this, you know, or the other way, like, Sue, how come her wine tastes better than my wine? Right.
And I foresaw that.
Really?
Absolutely. Because my original plan was to name the Rieslings after two blocks, and the ones that my niece looks after one, and my nephew looks, their bedrooms will go over different ones.
Yep.
And I thought, oh, what happens if one's better? So the strategy is you have to be dead to have a wine named after you. And so therefore, there's no animosity.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
So my mother's all excited, like, when are you going to name a wine after me? I'm like, well, when you're dead. It's like, well, I want a sparkling. I'm like, well, you don't get to pick. I pick.
Yeah.
You don't get. So she has, she's put it in her will.
She wants a sparkling.
She wants a sparkling.
That's fair.
She can try.
I mean,
she'll probably get one, but I'm not going to, you know, give expectations.
We'll go back to quotes, which is great because then I don't do the work. You've done the work for me. But you talk about, and it's something that every winemaker deals with, about the trends. You know, the late 80s, early 90s, a lot more oak, big extracted wines.
Sure.
Now everything is, you know, a little bit lighter. Everyone's organic. You know, unfiltered, unfined. There's just, you know, there's all these different trends that come and go. Mm. But the tough part is you can't make a wine next year for the trend of now, because, you know, it takes years and years to make wine. How hard is that for you guys and for a lot of the wineries just to forecast where things will be 5 years from now?
Right. It's very tough because we're into long-term planning. And so what we can do is tweak wines, and two things can happen. One, we can tweak a wine to fit the market, which is what I do with the Rieslings, that you know, I find the sweetness level changing a little bit year to year based on how I think people's palates are changing. And then the other one is just to really truly believe in what you're doing as far as your own house style. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, hence the Sue Ann Staff series of wines are the ones that really, you know what, okay, what is a classic Pinot Gris? What's a classic Pinot Grigio? So how are we crafting those wines to really be the best it can be for that category? And and then the Fancy Farm Girl ones are the ones that can be a bit more trendy and work a little bit with and bring different varietals in and bring different styles in as I see the market changing. Right now, I think what's really changing is the packaging. The packaging is what's really changing.
Really?
And people are keen to try wines in cans, in Tetra Paks. It's not the traditional 9-pound, glass bottle to signify this is a really great wine.
With a giant punt, you know, that in California with a really thick glass. Like, all right. Don't apologize for the wine. Let's just see what the wine is.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, and don't overcompensate.
Exactly, yeah. And I think our lifestyles are changing too. We're a lot more on the go. Mm-hmm. And so the package needs to accompany that. And I think that's right now where our changes are.
I'm glad you mentioned Pinot Grigio and Pinot Gris.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because for a lot of, like, this is good. This is a good sort of classic. Help the listeners out. Explain the difference.
Right. So they actually are the exact same grape. It's mm-hmm. just the style of how you're going to make it. So Pinot Grigio is typically made in the Northern Italian style, where it's fresh and bright and some smokiness to it. But we mean in stainless steel, so it's a lot more very approachable. Well, Pinot Gris classically is made in the Alsatian style, where it'd be a lot heavier, a lot more extract, potentially aged in oak barrels, potentially it would have gone through malolactic fermentation, potentially has higher alcohol to it. So it's just that much more of a weighty, intense wine.
Yeah,
that people, not everybody follows those rules though. But if you go to the classic rules, that's really kind of how they're differentiated. So I actually make both from the same vineyard, but different years. So 2016, when it was hot and dry, it was made in, I called it the Louis Pinot Gris, and it was made in the Alsatian style. Mm-hmm. So aged in oak barrels, malolactic. 2017, cool and wet, I made the Lenny, who'd be Louis's brother, Pinot Grigio. I made it in lighter, fresher, crisper style.
And who's Louis and Lenny?
Well, they would be my great-great-grandfather, or great-great-uncles.
Yeah.
One of them was born in this home, actually. I forget which one is older. Doesn't really matter. In January, but in the same calendar year, the other one was born in December. So they're in the same school, in the same class, going to school, and their brothers born at different times.
Really?
Crazy.
I feel like that could happen back in ye old days.
It was ye old days. So the first one was born in this home in January, and the second was born in the hospital. So I'm guessing the second was a preemie. And I remember some stories from my father and grandfather talking about how they kept a baby warm in this house by, you know, like basically in a box by the wood stove.
Yeah,
because it was so immature. So it must have been.
Oh God.
Yeah. Yeah.
So. I'm so glad we live in 2019.
Oh, I know it. Central heat, central air conditioning.
Oh yeah, it's the best. What did it mean to you back in 2002? You won the Ontario Winemaker of the Year. I believe you were the first female to win the award and the youngest ever.
Right.
So maybe you could go back, I guess, 17 years ago, ooh, just what that was like.
Right. Oh, my gosh. Yes.
I know.
Time flies, eh?
It really does.
Yeah. you know, I was just such a young and naive and ambitious Chicorama at the time. I remember being at the...
Where were you working?
I was the winemaker Pilateria Estates in Niagara Lake at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I had been on board there for, I guess, maybe 6 or 7 years. And I remember sitting there at the dinner going, oh, I wonder who the winemaker of the year is going to be. And I had three gentlemen in mind, and they're all like in their 60s and 70s. And I was like, oh, I wonder which one. And then my name was said. And I just, my first reaction also, first off, was like, what? Like, are you sure?
Uh-huh.
And because I just thought there's so many of the deserving people in the room. But what I failed to see was how far I'd come in 7 years, like totally oblivious to it. And the style of wines that had been created, really putting Pilateria on the map. But you know, worked really hard for it as well. But when you're working really hard, your head is down and you don't really fully pay attention to what all is going on around you and the impact that it's making. You're dedicated and focused and in your own world.
What were the wines? Or what was the wine? Like, what was the wine that got you the award?
Well, it wasn't really for one wine per se. It was for the breadth and styles of wines.
Yep.
And I think that was part of what worked as well. You know, Pilateria was really well known for ice wine. And then I made quite a mark making some gorgeous red wines for them that placed really well throughout Canada at different wine competitions. But it's when the sparkling started to win awards, and, you know, and making those three wines is so diverse that was where the flag went up to the people that decide, the powers that be, that somehow brought my name to the top of the list. And there it was. So, and it was in the months after that where I really saw the impact, because so many major news outlets were in to do interviews and telephone calls. And it's like, whew, okay, I think I have a picture of Flyer Magazine and Canadian Living and all those things too. It's like, all right, score. Yeah. Nice. All right, cool.
It's great. Yeah. So you, in 2002, you'd been making wine for 7 years.
About that. But 6 years, I guess.
6 years.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm. So what would you say the biggest difference is between you as a winemaker from 2002 to 2019?
Oh, well, a couple things. One is far more reactionary, I guess. I guess I'm not as proactive as I used to be because I think we're reacting a lot more to the environment and to what Mother Nature is dishing to us. Mm-hmm. I think my view on winemaking is certainly broadened in a sense that, because the way now I am not only a winemaker, but I'm also the winery owner as well. And sadly, I'm spending more time on the winery ownership side than the winemaking side. And luckily, I have a fantastic assistant winemaker, Chris Protonentis, that that is just immensely capable. And so we just kind of touch base every day and or 8 times a day on certain things, but he makes things happen for me, which is fabulous. And so I guess it's a lot more of understanding what makes wine work. And yes, it's the grapes and it's the wine, but I really didn't appreciate how much back end stuff there was as far as financing and logistics and marketing and all those things.
How nervous were you in 2009 when you know, I think you were working for 20 Bees and right. You know, you're doing stuff here, but mm-hmm. just when you decided, all right, that's it. I'm no longer at Megalomaniac. I'm mm-hmm. going on my own. I'm pushing all the chips in. I'm betting on me, and it's all about Sue Ann Staff Estate Winery.
Right.
Was it exciting? Was it nervous? Like what was that? What were your emotions back then?
Oh, it was pretty nerve wracking. Let me tell you, because my number one skill set is energy level. That I don't come with deep pockets. I didn't have there wasn't another income feeding into this. That it's solely relying on the winery.
So you didn't have a huge cache of tech money.
That's right.
That you could then, you know, do your project in Santa Barbara.
Well, there's an expression in the wine industry that if you want to make a small fortune in the wine industry, you have to start with a large fortune.
Yeah.
So my large fortune is my energy level, and it's not dollars. I obviously have an immense advantage by having a property I could fall back on, like my family property, which you know has been here for so long, and it was large enough to support what I wanted to do. So, I'm standing on the shoulders of the generations before me. Cause luckily, you know, the mortgage has been paid, so
yeah.
I don't have to worry about that in a sense. But even still, it's you couldn't start a winery more reasonable than what I did. I took my grandfather's old workshop and turned that into the tank room. The four-car garage used to have cars in it. Now they're all out, and that's the case goods storage for the next little bit. But it's about working with what you have, and hence the wine shop's in the kitchen in my home.
Yep.
This all will change. I want my kitchen back. I want my garage back. I want my dining room back. I might even get a boyfriend back too at the same time. I don't know. We'll see. I don't know.
And the dining room, it's gorgeous here, but yeah, there's glasses everywhere. There's some Cabernet, some Rosé all around. How did your family react when you told them that this is what you wanted to do? Because, as you said, standing on the shoulders of past generations, those past generations were very good at growing grapes, but not necessarily the focus was never making wine. How was the family's reaction?
Immense pride. And I think there was some fear factor for them, too, about how is this going to work. And then we came up with the plan of converting the garage building into the winery first. It's like, okay, you know what? Perfect. Taking tiny steps first, let's just kind of ease into this. I had been through the project at 20 Bees, which sadly went into receivership, the very first management of it. It was called Niagara Vintners Incorporated at the time, with a brand of 20 Bees. That 20 Bees had been purchased by Diamond Wines, so it's a whole very successful entity now, but at that time it wasn't. And so it was about coming home, learning the lessons from that. That was, you know, start way too big where it was impossible to afford. This is the complete opposite. Smart, start small and just let it grow. So I've totally burst the seams on every single building I'm working in. I joke that poor Chris, my assistant winemaker, has to go outside to change his mind when he's working in the tank room because it's a little full. The barrels are now stored off-site, which is less than ideal, but at least it's about keeping them in the perfect environment, though.
Yeah.
And but it'd be great to have it all back here and in a proper space. So that'll happen.
What's scarier? Mm-hmm. Landing a plane for the first time or the threat of rain during harvest?
Oh, you know what? Because my whole family, we all grew up flying. So I had that sensation and I was fine with the plane.
Yeah.
It's the rain. It's the rain and the wind and the hail. It's hail. Hail is the big one.
Yeah.
Where see those dark clouds come. Yeah. Now, is that a really big rainstorm, which the vineyards can handle no problem? Or does that have hail associated with it? That's where you get really afraid.
And yeah, well, I mean, you hear about it like, you know, in Chablis or in parts of Burgundy where all it is, or I think Meursault got hit a couple of years ago, where there's 10 minutes of hail and some producers lose 70% of their vines.
Right. It's completely devastating because it's like your vineyard went through the paper shredder.
Yeah.
It just rips the leaves apart, damages the berries, and sometimes the vineyard can recover. Sometimes those other outside berries are the ones that shrivel up and die, and the inside ones can live, but other times it's just a complete devastation, and it's go out, spray it, and just keep control of the pests and diseases, and that's it, and count it. Yeah, wait for another year.
Yeah, man plans, God laughs. You know, the idea. I think right. That's the old Hebrew expression. But let's get back to fly-in winery.
Right.
You guys are, could you please, I remember when I'm doing my research, and the Suhan Staff Estate Winery is the only one, it also is a fly-in winery. Explain. Yeah.
So there's two grass landing strips on the property here. There's a north-south that's 2,500 feet long, and an east-west that's 2,500 is the north south, 2,200 is the east west. And just flying's been part of our family right since the war days. My grandfather and great uncle were both pilots, and then it just kept going through the generations. My father, myself,
yeah.
My brother, my mom got up to her solo and decided it wasn't for her. And now that talk about all the hobbies being lost as you start a winery. Right. I haven't had 1 hour as pilot in command since I started the winery. So 11 years of a drought.
Yeah.
But I do intend every year, like, this is the year getting back into flying. This is But in the meantime, it's there.
Yeah.
I have about 6 to 8 customers a year that fly in to come and pick up some wine. They don't taste, obviously, when they come in to buy, but they know what they're looking for.
Or
they had driven here once before and had tasted, so they know what they want.
That's
so.
Pretty badass.
Oh yeah!
Fly in yep. to buy wine and then a fly off. That's
is that cool?
That's aspirational.
It is, and the only problem is all the other wineries near close by, and they're like, oh, look how Suanne's customers arrived today.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
Wow.
Yeah,
it's like, she fancy.
Pretty badass. You give them two middle. Hey, take that 13th Street.
Yeah. Bam. Boom.
Actually, before we get to Riesling, because you guys you do events here and you can do weddings, right?
Yes. Yeah.
I'm always curious about that. Have you ever had a wedding where the people wanted to bring their own wine?
Oh, I've had people want to bring their own everything.
Yeah.
I've learned how to say no, really. It's like, no, 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 no. And
yeah.
So, yes, they wanted to bring a wine, and they didn't understand why. And the one was, and this is, you know, it's kind of where we are with Niagara Wines now. I am not drinking Canadian red wine at my daughter's wedding.
Yep.
I'm like, yes, well, then I guess you're getting married. She's getting married somewhere else.
Yeah.
And like, nope, it's California or nothing. I'm like, well, I guess it's nothing. And he said, there's not a red wine you can make that I'm going to like. I'm like, I'm going to change your mind on that. And he was immensely adamant that, nope, and you need to come out and taste the barrels. I'm like, no, you'll taste it in a month and a half when it's ready.
Yeah.
It's fine. You relax. It's good.
Douchebag.
Well, you know what? In the end, he turned 180 degrees. Like, went, wow. He was really impressed with the reds.
What wine turned him?
It was a Cabernet Franc that had been in the barrel for 22 months. It was my Chestnut Tree Cabernet Franc. I didn't call it Chestnut Tree at the time, but it was the 2014 Cabernet Franc, and he was just gaga about it.
Yeah.
The next day, he came back in and bought a case before he left. So I'm like,
that's great.
Score.
And nice. God, the amount of times, and I hear it all the time, and I don't champion the wines here because of some sort of sense of patriotism or because I'm from here. I'm like, these are good wines.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Cab Franc, like, we talk a lot about Pinot Noir, and Pinot Noir obviously can work here because of the climate, but I don't think people realize just that Cab Franc, which is, it works in the cooler spots of Bordeaux, that Cab Franc is a fantastic grape that works really well in Niagara.
Right. Oh, absolutely. When it's treated properly, meaning you leave it on the vine long enough so that it gets ripe, you don't overcrop it, to really ensure you don't have those green, herbal, herbaceous notes.
Yeah.
And then off the chart, fantastic. You know, some of the most gorgeous wines in Bordeaux are 100% Cabernet Franc. So, and the other advantage here as well is it survives those really atrocious winters that we have sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's the most cold, hardy of the Bordeaux red grape varieties. So hence up here on the escarpment where I'm as far from the lake as you'd want to be to grow vinifera grapes, this is the best grape variety, the best Bordeaux grape variety to grow on this property is Cabernet Franc.
Yeah, I find like it's always sometimes my complaint is when wineries try to do 100% Cabernet Sauvignon. And I feel that the decision is more about economics than about nature because it's easier to sell Cabernet Sauvignon. But it's my complaint is that often it is, as you just mentioned, it's those green stalky. And I feel like I'm drinking a green bell pepper. And I don't mind if there's slight notes of it. But when that's dominating it, I don't want green in my Cabernet.
No,
Not at that level.
I want the green in the salad. Uh-huh. That's where it belongs.
Chocolate
not in my
ice
wine glass.
Cream. I don't want it in my Cabernet.
Exactly. And so interestingly, so the bottle is right beside you, actually, is a Cabernet Sauvignon, 100%. But I decided, because it didn't have the development, it's made me into a rosé.
Oh.
And so Cabernet Sauvignon Rosé is the way to go when it's not right.
Yeah.
So don't force something to happen. You'll just be immensely disappointed in the end. And so we fermented on the skins for 4 to 5 days instead, pressed it off. It's still aged in oak barrels for rosé. But
That's perfect. Yeah. Just what nature's given you, then you translate versus trying to force it.
One of my other quotes, force is about Mother Nature. And so one of my other quotes, I don't know if you have it there, that's if you want to get back to quotes, is Mother Nature, she trumps everything that you do. She can be your best friend or she's the biggest bitch on the block. Or the other. So
yeah. And when she's a bitch, you just got to roll with it. You're like, okay.
Exactly.
Nature's having one of her days. Yep. All right, let's just, everyone back off. And,
let her win. Yeah, just let her win.
Adjust accordingly.
Yes.
I was wondering to talk about your Riesling program here.
Yeah, so Riesling is about 75% of what is grown on the property here. There's 4 different blocks of it. And so, and 4 different ages, 2 different clones. And so between all those different numbers, we can create a really sensational Riesling program here that has immense consistency to it. The other neat part is one of the older blocks here is named Robert's Block, named after my great-great-great-grandfather, Robert, who was the original settler to the property here in, I think, like somewhere around the late 1800s, late 1700s, early 1800s. And that wine is a wine, I don't make it every year, only in premium Riesling years, like 11 and 14. I did make some in 16, even though 2016 was a hot year, but we picked it earlier. And in 2018, we made a little bit too. So, so that one, everyone's most favorite Riesling, though, is the Riesling Loved by Lou, named after my grandmother, Lula. She's the one that taught me how to do all the handwork in the vineyard, all the pruning and tying and thinning. She's my mentor. Mm-hmm. She's like 5 foot nothing and barely 100 pounds and kicked some serious bottom out there in the vineyards. And so when I started the winery, it was called Semi-Dry Riesling. And it was after she passed away, I renamed it in her honor because that was her favorite wine when she was still here. So nice. She was the one that was the proudest when I started the winery. Well, my parents were too, obviously, but
yeah.
Next in line definitely was grandma.
and she was out there in the fields?
She was, I'd say a big part of the success of the farm was her. That, back in those days, there was so much manual labor. She was out there with all the hand laborers. At times, the farm was so big, at times it'd be 100 people in the vineyards working and far out. She knew every single person, whether they're slacking off or not. She had a mental impression of each one of them as well. I loved working with her. I would coming home in the school bus, I'd be looking into all our farms, looking to see if I could see grandma's car. So I would come home and, hey, mom, grandma's at the Beamer farm, the Jones farm, and drop my bag and hop on the bike and go out and help her. And inevitably, but the first thing she'd give me to do would be, you go tell Bob, he's about 14 rows over and at the back, to put out his cigarette and get back to work. So I'd go across and go find Bob and, you're in trouble. You better put that cigarette out.
So you're the enforcer.
I was the enforcer. But I'm like 7, 8, 9 years old.
You're talking to an adult. Hey, You know, someone's a hard living. Hey, go put your cigarette out.
That's right. Yeah. Exactly. So,
what is Riesling work in Niagara? In the escarpment.
Where does it work?
No. Why do you think it works here? Yeah.
Sure. Well, there's so many factors that make it work. One is the climate. It's cool. It's perfect for Riesling. And the other one is the terroir. Riesling really needs the limestone rock and lime in the soil somehow in order to get that minerality that can come through. If not, without that limestone rock, you don't get that mineral, steely, flinty notes in the Rieslings, and they end up just kind of being fruit bombs. That the best quality Rieslings really come from soils that are like this. Also that clay soil as well. So it really holds the vine back. It's not too vigorous. It really makes sure the vine has a balance, promoting or just, you know, ensuring that half its life is going into keeping all the vigorous material alive, all the leaves and shoots, yeah, but an equal amount into the berries as well. And so you end up with fruit that just has the complexity and the nuances and that you expect from a classic Riesling. And there's so few areas in the world that really do it so well, just like this, you know, like the Mosel Valley, other parts of Germany, obviously, here, the Clare Valley in Australia, you know, spots of the Finger Lakes, but these are special parts of the world.
And how much are people buying it now versus when you started? Like, is Riesling an easier sell in 2019 than it was in 2009? Or is it still that uphill battle? Because Riesling, the joke is always every somm, everyone in the wine industry, they yell and scream that Riesling is the drink, Riesling's the drink, and then you go and look at the data, and it's not the one that everyone's drinking.
Riesling suffered a bad rap that I think we're finally over, in the sense that everyone thinks, at the beginning, the thought was, oh, Riesling's sweet. It's too sweet. I don't like it. Not fully grasping or not fully appreciating, I guess, is probably a better term, the range that Rieslings can be, and but the balance that Riesling needs as well. So yes, Riesling can be too sweet when it doesn't have the right acidity, but the right acidity, the right flavor, and then the right sweetness with it, it can absolutely sing. I think one of the best wines I ever had was from the Mosel Valley. I think it was in a St. Urban's Hof. It must have been. And it was 55 grams per liter residual sugar. So pretty high.
That's high.
That is high. Yeah. And yet...
Almost as much as a Napa Pinot.
Yeah. good one.
Such a nerdy wine. That is such a nerdy wine joke by me.
I love it.
That joke was for you, not for anyone. Like most people listen, like, shut up, Gauze.
So I'm going to use that in the wine shop sometime. Do it. Oh, Riesling is too sweet. Well, what type of Pinot do you drink?
Yeah, exactly.
Does it come from California?
Oh, you like Meiomi? Yeah, that's Kool-Aid. Yeah. All right.
Okay, guess what? You're okay here.
Yeah.
This one, you won't need a shot of insulin afterwards.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so I think Rieslings have become far better balanced, and I think all over the world.
Oh, but sorry, now, Stephanie, that 55 gram liter one you had.
It was so sweet, but also had so much flavor, so much intensity, so much minerality to it that like it literally vibrated on my palate. I'm like, wow, because I went into tasting that wine going 55 grams. That's ridiculous. That's a huge amount of wine.
Yeah,
amount of sugar. And anyway, it was fantastic. In fact, I'm far from a photographic memory, far, far, far from, but that wine has made such a photograph in my mind. Like I could taste it again and go like, I know what wine that is.
Yeah.
So I've had this before. So
what needs to happen to continue to knock down that stereotype of I'm not drinking Canadian red? I mean, I guess it's probably better now than when it was in 2002 when you won the winemaker, Ontario Winemaker right. Award. But it's still around.
Mm-hmm.
What needs to happen just for people to just sort of put that stereotype away?
Well, I think about all Canadian wine, we just have to keep on plugging away of educating people and teaching them, and proof is in the glass, like really be insistent or really need the sommeliers to get behind us and have our wines on the list. Have it to a point where there's no other options. Because when people taste it, when they have it repeatedly, they'll know that it's not just a one-off, that, you know what, the minds will change. We'll swing around to having our own citizens convinced that our wines are great.
Yeah.
I can't believe how often I still have the conversation that, I just never drink wines from Ontario or the impression that they're too expensive. And like, well, please don't try to compare our wines to wines that are mass made from, you know, Chile and Argentina.
Yeah.
And we just don't have that quantity of scale, and we just can't, we can't, and we won't, and we shouldn't try to attack those price points and those styles of wines anyway. We're this premium. We make great premium wines. We have nothing to be ashamed of. We should be putting our wines up against the best from Burgundy and Bordeaux and Alsace at every single day of the week. And, you know, and framing it that's what we do. We're not your $5 bottle of wine.
Oh no, and like all of there's no giant scale winery here. And mm-hmm. it's like people will, when you say, oh, we're gonna go for a boutique hamburger.
Right.
Yes. They'll spend more for, oh, this artisanal boutique hamburger than they would for something from McDonald's. And, you know, the wines here are not, it's not connoisseur. You know, it was a mass producer. We're actually pretty right. good for the price point in Chile. I think that's something people need to realize. There's no mass produced wine, in certainly not in Ontario.
No, absolutely not. And you know, when I compare wineries here to wineries in Australia, and I do that often because that's where my formal winemaking training came from, is from the University of Adelaide in South Australia. You know, like, there's about 15 wineries down there now that are the same size as the Ontario wine industry. There's mm-hmm. probably about four that are four times the size of the Ontario wine industry. Like they're processing over 200,000 tons a year, and so the wine industry here in Niagara, and the largest year we've had lately is 87,000 tons. We usually kind of this year, I guess we're probably about 65,000-68,000 tons. So yeah, so it sounds like so much wine, but when you compare it to other regions of the world, it really isn't.
Yeah.
And so even our largest wineries are, it would be a joke in Australia as far as how large they are. So,
oh, yeah, in Australia, yeah. Just giant, huge stainless steel towers that just go up and up. They're just, right. you know, in terms of the amount that's made, just these huge factories.
Yeah,
and I don't even mean that in a bad way, but it's
just,
it's massive tanks.
Yeah, and that's what they do, and they do it well. So let them do mm-hmm. that. And in Chile and Argentina, it's the same thing. So, and their growing conditions are different, and their labor conditions are different, and all those things, like, all make a huge difference into what our wines end up being and how they end up being priced as well.
Does the Ontario government do enough to help the Niagara wine industry?
Oh, we have to start all over, a whole other podcast then, because I could go on for hours on that. So there's so much more that needs to happen. And we're being huge advocates as well right now at Queen's Park, trying to get that through. Mm-hmm. Right now we do
What's
have
the biggest one or two? Then I'll make mm-hmm. it more specific.
Right.
Okay. What's a couple of the roadblocks that the government here does just to make your life more difficult?
Right. So there's two taxes in a sense that really make me all of us upset. So one is the fact that there's absolutely no advantage when we sell wines in the LCBO. When I sell a wine to the LCBO, what's happening is it's getting taxed exactly the same. The wine, it may as well go to the Queenston-Lewiston border mm-hmm. and come back into Ontario.
Really?
Because that's what's happening. If you're in California, selling to your local bottle shop in California, you wouldn't attract the same taxes that we are. So basically it's a 71.5% LCBO lift. Then there's levies and environmental levies and other taxes that go into it as well. So we need some type of taxation.
So you get taxed more than California, one of the highest taxed states. Actually, maybe the number one tax state. So you guys get taxed more than them.
Well, so we get taxed the exact same. If a California wine is coming into Ontario,
yeah.
we're getting the same tax that they are. And while that guy was selling to his own wine shop in California, that wouldn't happen. Mm-hmm. So we're all getting a 71.5% lift. And there is a little bit of a kickback right now, but it's from the government that comes back to us, but it's really minuscule compared to what we should be getting. And so this isn't about, like, this isn't asking for a handout. This is just about asking for a level playing field. Is what we're asking for already happens in British Columbia as far as it's basically a tax rebate every month. We want it every month, and we want it the same value that they have too, which is 50% of the price. Then it would only be like a 21.5% increase in a sense going to the LCBO. So
yeah,
so that's one thing. The other one, there's a 6.1% beer and wine fee that, so for every bottle of wine that I sell here at the winery, not only does it have HST and all the levies that go onto it, there's also a 6.1% beer and wine fee that goes onto it. And it's a fee, by the way. That means it's not a tax. So then we can put HST on top of the fee. So really, it's a tax on a tax, but we won't call it that. We'll call it a fee.
Yeah.
Therefore, you feel better about it, I guess. There is not another commodity in Ontario. There's not another commodity in the whole entire country that has a fee like this one. And I'll tell you, I mean, the number of checks I cut every month to the government exceeds any check I'll cut to myself.
Yeah.
And you know, HST, we have all accepted that and all the other taxes I pay. But it's that beer and wine fee, that 6.1%, that I'm like, you know what? This is my profit margin. This is my only profit margin, if there even is a profit margin. And I really feel like that money is mine. And if I were to keep it, it's just going to go right back into the business anyway.
Yeah. You're not going to buy a big screen TV or a new hot tub.
No.
You don't have time for a hot tub and a big screen TV.
Ironically, I have a hot tub. I haven't been in it about 8 months. So
really, oh no, there's nothing more sad than dust on the hot tub. Which, by the way, that's
so horrible.
I have a country band, and that's our number one song, "Dust on the Hot Tub." It's a very sad, very sad tune. We'll end on a happier note.
Okay.
And again, by the way, I really appreciate you doing this. And
oh, yeah.
I want you please promote, plug where people can come. But for you, for the Sue Ann Staff Estate Winery. Where would you like to be? Like 5, 10 years? What is your goal beyond getting your kitchen back?
That's a pretty big, lofty goal, though. So
yeah.
that is where I want to be 5, 10 years from now. So, yeah. So number one is a new production building, and so that hopefully will be not hopefully that will be on the docket for this spring, and that will allow me to increase the production. I really want to also get into some export markets as well. I have a little bit of wine going to China, a little bit to South Korea, a little bit into Europe. So mm-hmm. I'd like to really expand those and get fancy farm girl across the country. It is in Manitoba now, and some wines are in the LCBO, but there's lots of other fancy farm girls in Saskatchewan and Alberta that I know are thirsty for my wine.
Oh my God. I mean, you should be in Regina.
Yeah, absolutely.
You
so working
100%
on that.
100% be in Regina.
Yeah. So I have an agent, I think, that will carry the flag out there for me. So we're just nailing down all the other final details.
So what are the varietals for the Fancy Farm Girl? What are the different wines you're selling?
Right. So Fancy Farm Girl, there's the Frivolous White, which is a semi-dry Riesling. The Frisonesque Sauvignon Blanc, which is a dry Sauvignon Blanc. The Foxy Pink, which is a drier styled rosé. And the Flamboyant Red, which is a Bordeaux blend. Mm-hmm. You'll notice that they all start with F words, but not that F word.
Not that F word.
That F word's for the vineyard when a tractor breaks down or someone prunes a grapevine wrong.
Yeah.
That is clearly appropriate, but not for wine labels, you know.
Fudge. And for the Sue Ann staff, for the estate wines, what right now is available?
Right. So about 18 wines, I think, on that side of the list.
Oh,
now.
God.
So,
no, don't worry.
I know. So we'll go that far. But Riesling, it takes the cake.
Yeah.
With several styles of Riesling, everything from dry sparkling to a very quite sweet white. There's a Viognier blend, a Chardonnay, the new Cabernet Sauvignon Rosé, and then Bacchus Noir. Oh my gosh, it's like a crowd favorite. No oak aging to it, super fruity, and Cabernet Franc.
Nice. The Cab Franc would appeal to me. I've spent time with the specs, and we've gone back and forth about right. Bacchus Noir. You can't like it. If you like everything, you love nothing. So
we call Henry Pelham here Henry Bacchus. So
yeah. Yeah. And does a fantastic job. Yeah. But where can people find you? Website, address. When are you open for tastings? All the promote.
I
appreciate the time.
So right, we're up here on 3210 Staff Avenue in the little town of Jordan. So I'm just on top of the Niagara Escarpment. So you can plug in those coordinates into your thing, or open every single day from 10 until 6 on Sundays, from 11 until 5, and all year round. So you can walk in, fly in, drive in.
Yeah.
You can take a horse. I cycle in. We have lots of cyclists every year. I've got two cycling racks here waiting for you guys. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, it's easy to get to. I was able to get here quite easily from Toronto. First off, again, thank you so much for doing this. And congrats on just the success of you just following in your family's tradition. It's it's a great story. Your winery and your journey is a great story. And I appreciate you taking time to chat with me.
Oh, it was so much fun. Come again.
Absolutely. Oh, is there a website, by the way?
Oh, www.sue-annstaff.com.
Nice. Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, iHeartRadio, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.